the book.
Yeah, that is the book. I wish that that countdown went a little bit faster so the listeners at home could have heard that. Hello, welcome to Unfortunately Required Reading, where we are separate because Amanda has allergies and depression.
Yeah, and it's probably good because then I didn't really have to put as much effort in. So I had to go get a blood draw this morning, which I'm very, very thankful that my doctor's office is open on Saturdays because that's very rare out here. And so they were able to get me in. I laughed so hard, though, because I go in, I've got my full mask on, because they're very big about you have to wear a mask, regardless of whatever studies say right now. They're like, wear a mask. So I go in, I'm ready, I'm prepared, I'm ready to check in. I'm there 10 minutes early. I've got everything ready to go. Right after I sit down, within 5 minutes, two separate guys walk in. Neither of them have a mask on. And they both go, oh, shit, my bad. And like the girl, like, we'll give them one, the lady who's checking people in. And it was so funny because they were all like right on time for their appointment, no mask. And I'm like, am I better than everyone? Which the answer is no. But I love the lady who works for Quest. She and I had a really good conversation today, and they finally gave her a room to work in that's not like a broom closet.
That's awesome. I have to get blood work done a lot because I have a lot of chronic health conditions and anemia. But I was a dumb kid. I was a very fearless child. Like most children are. They don't understand the concept of death. I was a very fearless child. I developed all of my fears in my 20s. So now I'm horribly afraid of needles. I'm horribly afraid of that stuff. So I'm sitting there on my phone playing Bejeweled, like a 50-year-old wine mom, with my neck as far away turned from the woman using the softest baby needle because I have the softest baby veins.
Mine, I've got it down to a science now, and I think this is just us being fun times chronically ill. I'll just walk in, I point up my arm, I show the exact spot, I go, this is probably the only place you're going to be able to get blood out. 9 times out of 10, they're able to get it, no problem. That is trial and error over 38 years, y'all. Because, I mean, people used to try and get it from, like, the center vein, like, right where your arm bends. No, yes. My veins aren't ready to play. If I was a heroin user, it would be impossible. It would have to be injected between my toes because it's, like, impossible to get these veins to cooperate. And if they put it in the top of my hand, then it's bruised for like the next 6 weeks. I kid you not. It is ridiculous. When I had surgery on my abdomen, it was like to get my gallbladder out. It's nothing exciting. The scars hurt less than my hand did after a few days. So
I was actually accused of being an IV drug user once in the hospital because my veins were so poor, and also racism. But I had to do blood work because I was in the ER, and the nurse said, how long have you been using injectables? It's like, never. Never.
Is it bad that my brain went injectables and then put in Uncrustables? And I'm like, I don't know.
I can't eat because I can't have peanut butter. We're talking about Dr. Zhivago today because it's technically a romance, and we also feel like negging Russia.
Yeah. So really fun story. My husband tried to play the Atomic Heart game, and he gave it up real quick because he's like, this is just Russian fucking propaganda.
Yeah.
And that's and if you've been listening to the podcast for all, you know, I had very, very deep interest in Russia and Slavic paganism. And mythology and stuff like that. It is moved. I feel bad for the Russian people. And I will say that because there's a lot of very young people in St. Petersburg and Moscow and other areas that want nothing to do with this. And of course they're being silenced. Because that's what Russia does. And has always done. And when we go into a little bit of the background of this book, you're going to hear that too. Russia hates this book.
Yeah.
Hates this book. And that's for a lot of reasons. What are you drinking right now? Because I stuck with Diet Coke because my stomach is crazy right now.
I made a vodka soda with Sprite, and I have this pear elderflower vodka. in a mug from Japan.
I mean, that works.
So
fun story before we begin. One of the things, the contributing factors to the Russian Revolution is Tsar Nicholas II deciding to go to war with Japan over a port.
Yes.
And then them proceeding to get their ass kicked and having spent a ton of money. So the Japan Cup actually works for this.
It does. Also, while we're completely sidebarring, Victoria, would you like to tell the listeners at home what I had to hide before maintenance came over?
Oh my god, do you want me to discuss it in its gigantic glory?
Yes.
Okay.
It's not that big.
Fun story. I'm talking to Amanda this week. We talk to each other pretty much every day, unless one of us is super depressed. Yes. And then we're just like, I'm alive, I'll talk to you later.
Yeah.
And that goes back and forth. It is not just Amanda, it is not just me. Like, it is a spectrum. Anyhow, correct. Amanda has maintenance coming over. She looks up, she has a large fake dick on her bookshelf.
Yep.
That it has a pierced tip, friends.
Oh, it's pierced all the way.
It is not something that maintenance would probably understand. Now, keep in mind, my husband worked maintenance when we first got married. So he's seen some shit. And thankfully, he is not your maintenance man, because that would have been a really awkward conversation. Amanda goes, I got to make sure I take that off the shelf. Forgets. And then as the maintenance man is coming to the door, takes it from the shelf and yeets it across the room to the couch to hide it. And all I could picture was Amanda throwing this pierced dick across the room, and it just, like, in my head, it grew wings and just flew. And I'm sorry, Baron Von Cheeseplate, that you're listening to this, but
Baron Von Cheeseplate knows. For context, I'm gender fluid. So the dick is a packer. It's not like anything super, super lewd. It's gender affirming. But I don't really wear it out of the house because I have giant tits and a fat ass, and I don't really pass for male anymore. And I feel like walking around with a giant bulge and fat tits is a great way to get sexually harassed. So I don't really wear it outside of like very specific cosplay or like needing to feel affirmed at home. Which is why it's on the bookshelf and not, like, somewhere more sacred. But it's like, I should probably hide this before maintenance comes over.
Trying to explain it. So I didn't know what a packer was until one of my very good friends that I worked with, who's a lesbian and amazing, and was like, yeah, I'm going to go to the club. I'm going to be packing. And I'm like, you're going to carry a gun? And that was a very informative conversation, and I love her so much, and she's living her best life in Vegas now. And
haven't even thought of it like that in so many years, because I'm very anti-gun, or at least like I'm very anti-modern gun, but like never had to consider that if someone doesn't know what I'm in referencing, if I just go now, oh, I'm gonna go back tonight, they're like, why are you carrying a weapon? But yeah, so those are the conversations.
I mean, it could be used as a weapon.
It is 100% silicone and thoroughly pierced, so yes, it probably
I gonna say, did you see Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels? You know, someone can get killed by one of these.
Yes. So these are the conversations your hosts have during the week. Let's talk about a series of sad Russian people.
Okay. So this is actually, for once, the short story long is shorter than the book, which
for the first time ever.
And too much to read in 2 weeks when you don't want to feel sad all the time. But anyway, sure. So Yuri Zhivago is a young man who sees his mother die when he's super young. So we start at her funeral. His dad really isn't around, and he doesn't understand this until his mom drops dead, and he's raised by his uncle Kolya, who is a priest who is asked to be defrocked, which I don't need any more hot priests in my life. Thank you. Yuri ends up going to university in Moscow and studies medicine. I'm having a hard time not being like Moskova, which stupid, I know. He meets a woman named Tanya. They get married after her mom kind of makes him promise that they will get married. Mm-hmm. And they have a little boy. I don't know where all my typos are this week, but here they are. They have a little boy named Sasha.
I fixed them.
It's wart time because it's Russia. And Yuri becomes a medical officer in the army. Mm-hmm. He gets stationed in a very small town, which there's not a whole lot going on there. He does mm-hmm. complain about the placement of the stove, which I thought was hilarious.
Yes.
He runs into a young woman named Laura, who's, yeah, he's actually met two separate times under really, really upsetting circumstances. The first time he meets Laura, she is at a home of a woman who is just trying to commit suicide. Turns out that's her mom. And Laura is asleep on this couch. And he's like, oh, she's so pretty. And she's like a teenager. So I'm going to let that go.
Yes.
The second time, Laura is at a party where she tries to shoot a guy named Komarovsky, who has been like, who evidently seduced her and then like was holding that over her head. And instead, mm-hmm. she accidentally wounds a dude who is a prosecutor, which is always a bad plan.
Yes.
Laura gets married to a guy named Pasha Antipov. Or Antipov, which mm-hmm. kind of is how she's referred to a lot in the book, is by his last name. After her husband joins the military, he goes missing. Laura leaves their daughter behind with family and becomes a nurse for the military. And she goes west to try and find her missing soldier husband because she's like, what the hell happened to him? He stopped writing. Yuri finds himself super into Laura when they run into each other, but he's like, I can't do this. He goes back to his wife and son in Moscow. There's a whole part about how he like will stand outside her door once he figures out what room is hers. But then he's like, I can't go through with it. And mm-hmm. he even like is justifying for a while going, I don't even know where her room is in this house. Like,
which is super sketchy.
Yeah. His family, like when he gets back to Moscow, is struggling for food and basics like firewood to heat their home. There's a whole bunch of stuff about people disassembling old fences and breaking down furniture and turning that into firewood. Mm-hmm. The people who were wealthy often will volunteer like bottles of old schnapps and stuff that they have in their house. Mm-hmm. People are desperate. At one point in time, he brings over like a duck and they get a bottle of vodka, but they have no side dishes for the duck and nothing to accompany the vodka. So it becomes kind of this whole thing of like, sometimes when you're standing alone with your luxuries, you don't really, it's not really a luxury and you really just kind of, it's a whole thing. Anyway, they end up moving to Varniko. It's an estate her grandfather, Tanya's grandfather, used to own, mm-hmm. which has been turned into a collective. So that's a big thing. Once the serfs were freed, they ended up, you know, having to go somewhere. And then as, you know, the Russian Revolution starts, they start to make collectives and things like that. Mm-hmm. They get there after a really long and difficult trip. They find food and wood and are like, oh, great. Yuri ends up going to the neighboring town to use their library and runs into Laura again. They begin an affair that lasts a couple months and Yuri decides to break it off and confess everything to his wife. Mm-hmm. But as he's going back home, he gets captured by the partisan army and they force conscript him as a doctor. They're like, oh, we need doctors. And he's like, I don't want to be part of this. And they're like, sure you do. He's stuck with the army through the war between the white Russians and communist reds, which I'll probably have to explain. When he is released, he goes to find Laura. They spend months together and they go into hiding. Mm-hmm. Laura's former husband is a leader in the Urals, with the reds. But he's also wanted for his crimes. Komarovsky, who Laura does not care for, tells everybody that they need to go east so they don't get killed because mm-hmm. war is coming and everybody's going to die. Yuri's son and wife, so Tanya and his son Sasha, have been exiled to Paris and he's given the opportunity to join them. They're like, okay, we'll get you out because of their associations. They're what are called white Russians, which is where mm-hmm. the drink comes from. And Yuri tricks Laura into taking her daughter and going off to the east with Komarovsky, but he remains behind. So he's like, I'll come with you, don't worry. And then sends her off and he's like, I'm gonna face my fate here like a man, which is a whole theme in this book. Mm-hmm. He goes back to Moscow, starts working. He ends up living with a woman named Marina, who is the daughter of a family friend. And of course they have two kids. His old friends, Misha and Nikki, tried to get him to decide between Tanya, his wife who's in France, and Marina. He finds a new job and dies of a heart attack on the first day, which is prescient because Pasternak ended up dying of a heart attack. That's neither here nor there. well, of heart disease. And Laura comes to the funeral and asks Gary's half-brother if there's a way to track the location of a child who was given away to strangers. And they start putting pieces together. She disappears, as Laura does, likely dying in a concentration camp. Misha and Nikki end up fighting in World War II and run into a girl named Tanya. And they put the pieces together and find out that she is the daughter of Laura and Yuri Zhivago. The end. Yeah.
I don't know why I voted towards choosing this.
I don't know why either, but
I think it's because I've only like seen the movie and the movie was hot.
Wait, which one? With Keira Knightley or with Barbara Streisand?
Oh my god, hold on. There's one,
the one from the 60s with Barbara.
Yeah, it's the 65 one.
Okay.
It's the 65 one. Because Alec Guinness is in it. And like, yeah. So like, I remember forever ago seeing like bits and pieces of the 60s one. Because it's a 3-hour movie. Fun fact. The 60s one is 3 hours and 17 minutes. But I don't know why I contributed to this. This was terrible. This was a bad idea.
So every time, except this time, when I've been tempted to suggest a Russian novel for this show, I always have to remind myself they're very long.
Yes, they are. They're
very depressing.
Yes, they are.
And there's going to be a lot of stuff in it that just makes me go, why? And I like Russian literature, so go figure. But this I do not care for. However,
yes,
its historical impact is really important, and we'll get into that.
We will.
So some things to kind of discuss before we get started.
Yes.
There's a concept of the patronymic in Russian. So patriarchal society, how you identify people, especially when there's a lot of people named Ivan. You usually will use, there's a first and last name, but usually you'll also have the patronymic. And the patronymic identifies who your father was. And this is, that's very common in countries like Scandinavian countries and Iceland, where you have the father's name and it's like son of, or in Ireland, O'Connor, son of Connor, that kind of stuff. But for example, the father's name will start at the beginning. So for a guy, the last portion is Vich. So if your father was Ivan, your patronymic is Ivanovich. If you're a woman, it would be like Ivanova, because it's Ova at the end, or Ava, depending on. So that is very common. You have this a lot in this book. There's Alexievich, like, or Alexandrovich multiple times. And it's just to kind of be like, oh, that's so-and-so's kid. Especially, you know, when there's a lot of people in one small community, that kind of thing. Smaller towns and things like that. So anyway, if you ever wondered why Russians will sometimes have three names at once, that's why.
Yeah. So,
the Russian Revolution sucked. And
I love that we're skipping straight to that one.
I will go to Lonely's in a minute, but I want to give kind of some background.
The Russian Revolution was trash.
You'll hear a lot of stuff about Rasputin. You'll hear a lot of stuff that blames Nicholas II's wife.
Yes.
Nicholas II was not a good czar. He was not trained to be the czar. He was like the he was the spare. The person
Queen Victoria.
It's true though. Yeah. All of Europe at one point in time was mostly connected by Queen Victoria's children.
Yes.
She dies in 1901.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Cutler, for making me remember that, because my name is Victoria and you like to call me out in class. It's 1901. She dies.
Yes.
Her kids, her grandkids are still around.
Yes.
One of her granddaughters ends up being like the princess of Greece and becomes Prince Philip's mom.
Yes.
Who was married to Queen Elizabeth. Right. So that still continued on for a little bit. Nikki's wife, Alexandrina, was, I think, Queen Victoria's granddaughter. For a long time, Europe didn't move against each other, even if there were rough pains or trade issues or things like that, because no one wanted to piss off grandmama.
Yes.
Which, Good point.
And like literally grandmama. Like there's a reason why in Prince Harry's terrible book, which you should not read, he refers to her as grandmother of Europe. Yes, I've read his horrible book.
I'm partway through it.
I don't want to start on royalist bashing, but like I don't like him and I don't like his dumb book.
Point noted. So as far as the Russian Revolution goes, there's a lot of factors.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just, oh, Rasputin was here and nobody trusted him. Oh, maybe the queen is sleeping with him, which she wasn't. It's a very, very popular myth.
Why are we protecting the queen's honor?
I'm not trying to. I'm just saying like that's one of the common phrases that follows it. Because we like to disgrace women to make them look like they're worthy of blame, even when they're... Anyway, that's feminist nonsense, neither here nor there. So, Nikki sucks as a czar, right? Yeah. His family previously has released the serfs from their farms. So it's basically a form of slavery. It's not as like African slavery where or like anything in the islands where they're kidnapped and stuff like that.
These it's not chattel slavery. It's basically
it's not chattel slavery.
It's indentured servitude, but worse. Exactly. Like because I will fight you on that because a lot of people have tried to make that like argument where it's like, oh, it was just like slavery. And like all the black people rise up and it's like, no, it fucking wasn't.
That's why I wanted to be specific there about my phrasing. Because,
no, you did great.
So you have all these people who previously had been working on farms
mm-hmm.
and had been moved around by people, you know, getting married and doing that kind of thing
mm-hmm.
with no jobs because mm-hmm. people would be like, well, I don't want to pay you to work on my farm. You know, I used to just, you had land and you did mm-hmm. that and you made your food. Like, no, I don't want to do that. So you had a lot of people moving to cities. You had a lot of people who were unemployed. You had a lot of people who mm-hmm. were starving and having a real rough time.
Mm-hmm.
One of the initial stories about Tsar Nicholas II is his, like we're buddies. Anyhow,
I know
the day of his like coronation, the celebration, everybody comes forward and was a big cultural thing where, the leadership would provide vodka for the masses.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody started a rumor in the crowd that there was not enough vodka for everybody. And there was a rush. And it ended up crushing a bunch of people. And it was considered mm-hmm. to be this big pall over him.
Mm-hmm.
So following that, he's not a good leader. He doesn't really have any solutions for the serfs. The people rise up and create what's called the Duma, which is basically like their House of Representatives.
Okay.
And
I'm not going to let you sit here and bash Nicholas II further. He was not a good leader for Russia. You can definitely see that his roots are somewhere else in a different time and for a different set of people. But I'm not going to sit here and let you continue to bash this man who really was doing his best.
The man used to run around the streets in his youth, pretending to be a wolf with his friends and drinking champagne out of a tub, dude.
And Victoria built little forts for her grandchildren to play war games in. Almost like that ended up being fucking foreshadowing. You can see Albert's fort dug into the ground that you can just play in. Children still play in it. I want to play in it.
There we go. You want to play in it.
Let's go. I want to play war games in Victoria's little fortress.
So the Duma is formed. The problem is they have no teeth because Nicholas is like, here, you can have your little parliament or whatever you want, mm-hmm. but I'm not going to enforce your policies. So then he gets bored and disbands the Duma, which ends up giving power to a bunch of people who have been talking about socialism and talking about rising up. And we have mm-hmm. the Bolsheviks rise up. This book mentions a lot of hatred for the Bolsheviks for very good reason. We'll get into that, especially with his Pasternak's history and family. So you have the White Russians, which are those who are loyal to the Tsar and loyal mm-hmm. to the previous sense of government and how things are run. And then you have the Red Russians, which are more socialism, more power to the people, more we're going to make collectives and group factories. The problem is there is massive violence on both sides. when the story is told to the outside world, and this is where Pasternak gets in trouble, when it's told to the outside world, it's, oh, the people rose up and it was a beautiful thing and everybody was happy and taken care of and look how beautiful our society is. Because mm-hmm. that was the message that the USSR wanted the world to have. It did not work that way. It did not work smoothly. And if you ever talk to people who were raised in the USSR, even like my age, there's like a lot of, oh yeah, about that. It's rough. And Pasternak does not shy away from that in Dr. Zhivago, which got him into a lot of trouble. Yes. So that's kind of a primer on the Russian Revolution. There are much better sources to discuss it, but just to kind of give you some briefness.
We recommend the animated movie by Don Bluth, Anastasia.
No, we do not. The most historically inaccurate movie. And then you're like watching me get mad about Anastasia. It's a whole thing.
But I love that movie so much.
I'm going to start singing In the Dark of the Night at you then.
Please, don't you threaten me with a good time. Don't you threaten me with a good time.
One of the themes in this book is loneliness, which I skipped over. But
to talk about Russia.
Talk about Russia.
There's a lot of loneliness in this sort of like modern, postmodern sense of like you can be surrounded by people and still feel incredibly lonely. Because I guess you're a super, super special boy and you don't feel connected to the rest of the world because of how super special of a boy you are.
Yeah. And a lot of it boils down to like, Yuri always kind of has this melancholy to him of where he's struggles with connection. And like, they kind of relate it back to, oh, his mom died when he was little. He was raised by his uncle who taught him to do certain things. Oh, his marriage to Tanya, you know, it's there, but, you know, they're very different people from different strata and things like that. And it kind of like boils down to, look, Laura really understands his soul. Okay. I mean, does she? But okay. So as you can probably tell, Amanda and I, neither of us really enjoyed this book. That's a whole other thing.
I would have been much happier just rewatching The King's Man.
I still need to see that. I still haven't seen it. I know it's a sin. I have to tell my husband to find it. Anyway, The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent last night, which was hilarious. It's so good. Nick Cage being Nick Cage is just magical, and Pedro Pascal as always.
Oh, we can watch that Jesus movie where Willem Dafoe is Jesus.
Okay, so Amanda was watching a whole thing yesterday on white portrayals of Jesus. Do you want to tell us about that?
I was watching a video essay by Entertain the Elk, a video essayist that I love. I love Entertain the Elk. And he was talking about, you know, how Jesus looked, and he really focused in on white Jesus and how we got this cultural, you know, push for white Jesus. A lot of it's because of colonialism and how crappy the church is. And he goes over like this semi-modern list of depictions of Jesus that are white men. And in that list is Willem Dafoe and Joaquin Phoenix. And I had to message Victoria that because I don't know how I feel about living in a world. Because especially the Willem Dafoe one, because, you know, he has the beard and everything. I was almost convinced, like, that guy looks a lot like Willem Dafoe. And then I paused and I was like, pretty sure that's Willem Dafoe. It was Willem Dafoe.
And
Joaquin Phoenix was just Joaquin Phoenix as Jesus, who's married to Mary Magdalene, which is not the story I thought I needed from Joaquin Phoenix. I frankly need no stories with him, except for Gladiator.
Except for Gladiator.
Listen.
Okay, coming back to the book. Coming back to the book. So, individualism in a time of collectivism. This alone would have been enough to get this book banned, and it was. But in a society where all you talk about is how everybody works together as the people, They work mm-hmm. in collective. They mm-hmm. work together with the means of production, mm-hmm. each according to his needs. Having the narrative focus on an individual and his thoughts and his refusal to be like part of the collective and stand mm-hmm. alone and that kind of thing, that enough would have been enough to get this book banned, because it did not follow standard Soviet thought.
No, it did not.
Well, at least what was given to everybody, not necessarily how that actually worked out with people in power.
Yeah, because, you know, when you pull the curtain back, a lot of people that said they wanted, you know, the common man to have access to everything, they sure did love withholding access to everything.
Mm-hmm. Or being the ones who got the first choice of meat, or being the ones who had two separate types of chocolate made in the same factory, one that went to party members and one that went to the people.
Okay. As an only child, that sounds like something I would have done.
As an only child.
As a firstborn of the grandchildren and an only child, that sounds...
Yeah, so I wasn't the firstborn of the grandchildren or an only child, so...
I was the firstborn of the grandchildren, and I was my family's only child. I don't think I walked for the first, like, 5 years of my life. Not because I couldn't. I was never allowed to touch the ground.
You sound like my first few cats.
Oh, I was a wretched little gremlin. I was terrible. Also, do we get to talk about Lenin's mummy?
Sure. I have a whole book on it. Now I want to go read it. Anyway, so because it's fun. Vladimir Lenin.
Yes.
Not to be confused with Vladimir Putin. Vladimir Lenin shows up as
a big
figure. And he, when he passed away, his body was preserved. And it was a big deal because people wanted to come to his funeral and say goodbye because he was the great leader and all this shit. His body still exists to this day, which if that sounds fucking weird, it should.
Yes.
They initially were just kind of like holding this funeral and continuing to have it so people could come see it. They ended up building him like this tomb right like off of Red Square, which is like the big area with all the military, and right next to why can't I think of the name of it right now? The Kremlin. Thank you. Brain finally snapping back into place. And they will close it once a year to refresh the body. Now, the chemicals that they use to preserve the body are a state secret.
There
is a specific team that works to preserve this body. Like, there are grants that are designed to continue to keep this up to date. At this point in time, the body is probably more plastic and more preservative than it is actual skin or body parts.
It's a lot of formaldehyde and wax at this stage.
Yes. Because it's been almost 100 years.
Yeah, I do remember there was a huge like ship of Theseus problem, because especially as, you know, people who were there started to grow older and die, it was sort of like, but he's not him anymore. Like at this stage, he's mostly like wax and Soviet secrets, which, I mean, pop off, I guess.
You are not allowed to photograph the body when you're in there.
You are
not. You have to be silent.
You do.
You have to be dressed appropriately.
Yes.
It's like going to visit your grandmother's tomb. Like, if you have that kind of luxury. It is, which our family doesn't.
I was like, what the fuck are you talking about?
it's a big deal. Like,
it's a big
deal. To be able to go. Yeah. And, I mean, I'm bummed I'm never going to get to go and see that because, well.
Yeah. I think it was like before the war started, when Tori was in her Russian phase. I think like we briefly floated the idea of going to Russia, and then we realized we would not survive there.
Yeah, I'm way too mouthy. Well, and I remember I had this whole discussion with my husband, and he's like, "You're not gonna get to go to Russia." And I'm like, "Well, why not?" He's like, "Because it's fucking Russia." And keep in mind, this was like shortly after they had hosted like the World Cup and the Olympics and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So it seemed briefly like maybe we were coming to an understanding. And then we realized that the Cold War never actually
when they dragged out all the nice things, you know, to make it seem like everything was okay. Yeah. But
so
the loneliness is interesting, and also the individualism versus collective, because you still see that tie right now happening in Russia with Russian media, because of course we're going to talk about the war because it's been a year. Where dissent has to be so silenced so quickly, because any amount of dissent immediately cuts across why we're doing this. They cannot afford any level of dissent because the facade is so fragile. This isn't like, you know, in the 2000s when we went to war with Iraq and everyone supported that, even though it was wrong. Obviously an economic land grab and entirely our fault that the Taliban exists to begin with.
No disagreement there. There's also a reason that a lot of Latin America is unstabilized. Thanks, CIA. Yeah,
like, that's our fault. That's our fault. And also, like, we knew that they weren't in Iraq. We knew that. We knew it was always Afghanistan. We are the reason the Taliban exists. I don't have time for this. But, like,
oh, we could go into the whole Russia being in Afghanistan before us. Anyway, sorry, go.
No, we don't have time for this. But we all agree. I was fucking like a child. Like, yeah, let's go. We all believed in that. The facade there, that veneer is so thin that if anyone raises a hand and genuinely asks, what the fuck is going on? It shatters. There's this thing when you're watching a movie called Suspension of Disbelief. And it tends to happen the more fantastical the movie is that, you know, you already have to suspend your disbelief a certain amount when you're watching a depiction of something on film, because you know that's not real. But the more fantastical it gets, the more you have to suspend your disbelief. And most people have a breaking point. For a lot of folks, it's musicals. Like, they can survive a lot of things, but they don't get why everyone would just know this song and why they've all stopped in the middle of the street to sing it. For me, I don't remember where my suspension of disbelief broke, but I'm not going to bore you guys with that. That's sort of like what's going on over there, is this war is not going the way anyone expected. They also were convinced that for whatever reason, the U.S. was going to back out, and when has the U.S. ever backed out of anything, even when we should have?
I mean, we're like a drunken man in a bar fight, all right? You were talking to my friend, and I don't like it.
Right, and it's like, it's not even a person we know. It's
like, although usually the friend who is in another country has to get punched in the face a few times first before we step in.
Well, TBH, it has to be our problem, usually before we step in.
Japan punches us in the face and we're like, World War II, let's go!
Yeah, we're gonna drop the sun twice. The only funny skit that Robot Chicken has ever done was a World War II skit that I'm not gonna disclose the title of because it's bad, but America doesn't get involved until Japan like knocks something over on its desk and then it gets involved.
But like, I just think of Eddie Izzard or Eddie Izzard, if we want to be accurate. You guys were watching a cavalry film at the time. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
It's crazy. It's absolutely insane. And I am just as empathetic to the Russians on the ground. I don't think that that means that they deserve to die horribly in Ukrainian forests. I'm sure you're aware of where we stand on the side of this conflict. I would like to point you into the direction of a sticker that we have still in our shop that proceeds do go to charity. So you see this idea that your individual thoughts can harm the collective. We'll make it about America again. When we finally did start criticizing the war in Iraq, how fast any of that questioning started to bring the whole thing down. there's this really, really weird thing, especially in the US with like conspiracy theories. Because we're a weird fucking country. We're just weird. And one of the reasons why so many of like the tentpole conspiracy theories, I'm not going to talk about QAnon because we'd be here all day, but like your 9/11 truthers, your JFK was an inside job kind of thing, is it really only takes a few people before suddenly you have everyone questioning. And how fast that was relatively for both of those events. And that is one of those moments where individualism began to hurt the collective, until the collective became people that all agreed in these conspiracy theories. And we can see Russia having a similar crisis of faith because they don't wield the same power of the Orthodox Church that they used to. They are also fighting a huge media battle in which they cannot win. This isn't like North Korea where they can control more of the media. People can see the outside world and they have a lot of fucking questions.
Well, also, one of the things that Pasternak got in trouble for in this book mm-hmm. is he makes a ton of religious references, Orthodox references.
Mm-hmm.
Big things always happen around religious festivals. Mm-hmm. There's always mentionings of the certain bells, his uncle being, you know, a defrocked priest. Mm-hmm. All of these little references to orthodoxy and prayer and things like that, things that were very important to the Russian people before mm-hmm. the revolution, where, you know, it was like, okay, atheism is our state religion. Mm-hmm. And you still always had those few people who would like very quietly follow their religion. And now mm-hmm. that it's, you know, allowed again, you'll see like Putin and other figures pay lip service to it. Oh, this is important. This is important. But during Pasternak's time, that was another individual choice that was seen to go against the collective.
Absolutely. Like it's interesting that despite us both hating this, that this felt like a very apt time to read it. The next book we read is also very aptly.
Oh my God.
Welcome to the.
I still just remember right before lockdown, us reading Lord of the Flies. So,
and having these like deep conversations where I am very drunk about how, no, I don't think that anyone would do the right thing for others.
And we were right.
And for 3 years.
We laugh in millennial.
Yeah, laughs in exhausted millennial. But yeah,
you laugh really hard. I saw this meme the other day and it was like, good for you millennials having to plan for a future you don't believe in.
Yeah, I have been seeing a lot of that on my various feeds where it's like, oh, the retirement age is increasing. It's like, funny for you to assume we'll still exist by this year. Because, oh man, those oceans sure are rising. And that toxic explosion that happened in Ohio also happened in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And it's happened in other states. And we won't know the full impact of that until many years later. But as of now in Ohio, water is testing very acidic. If you throw something into a body of water, it has an oily sheen. And animals are dying. Which are, checks notes, bad.
What's really weird is to leave your religion behind and then see all the signs of the apocalypse.
Well, the apocalypse was a very secular thing for the Greeks because it was really just a turning over of a new leaf, just like Animal Crossing.
Oh my God! And Amanda makes it about Animal Crossing. I feel like that should be on the bingo card.
But, you know, it really was just meant to be, you know, this, like, this... Oh, my God. It was meant to just be like this, you know, the changing of the guard, basically. Christianity made apocalyptic literature into death, doom, and gloom. Because Christians didn't know how to have fun.
I mean...
the pagans were like, oh yeah, the apocalypse sounds great. As long as you get pissed drunk in the forest, you're fine.
I want to get pissed drunk in the forest.
Yeah, that sounds baller. But it was the Christians that made it like, oh no, there's a fiery whore beast outside.
See, I got excited about things like going to Vegas or leaving the state because I can get edibles in other states.
Though the fiery whore beast at this time sounds quite interesting. Do we want to talk about the author of this book and the book? I see you've written approximately 30,000 notes.
Oh, and there's so much more. Okay. So Pasternak was born when Russia was still using the Gregorian calendar. Oh, by the way, that got changed over. Or what was it? No, not the Gregorian. I don't remember. Anyway, the old calendar to the new calendar. So Orthodoxy had a different calendar than Roman Catholicism due to a schism. We don't have time to go into it. Anyway, it got brought back up. So his birthday shows up in different places as either February 10th or January 29th in 1890. It was more likely February 10th. Go with it. He was born Boris Leonidovich Pasternak. He had killer cheekbones. The picture, I'm like, damn, what the hell? His dad was a post-impressionist painter named Leonid Pasternak. He was a professor at the Moscow School of Painting, Sculpture, and Architecture. His mom was a concert pianist, and she was the daughter of an industrialist named Rosa Kaufman. Cool. They claimed to be descended from a famous Sephardic Jewish philosopher and treasurer of Portugal named Isaac Abravanel. So this is not so much of a side note, but just so you know, his family was very Jewish, which has never been a popular thing or safe thing to be in Russia.
Or anywhere, unfortunately.
Yeah. Even as recent as the 90s, and you know, even in the past few years, Russian people have been forcefully escorted out of Russia. Or Jewish people have, and it's not a good thing. I don't really know how to be like, that's fucked up, other than that. Anyway,
yeah,
he went to school in Ukraine, and people thought that he went to a military academy, so you see a lot of stuff about him being in a military academy, but it's not true. Their school uniforms just look like a military academy uniform, but they weren't. Mm-hmm. He met his friend Peter Minkaevich, I'm sorry, I'm butchering that, who ended up being the basis of one of his characters in Dr. Zhivago. Mm-hmm. He ended up going to Moscow, the Moscow Conservatory, to study music. And mm-hmm. then later he went to Germany to study philosophy. Because Leo Tolstoy was actually a close family friend. And you can see references to Tolstoy a lot in this book, other than the fact that he was a massive cultural icon, and people tended to follow his thoughts. Mm-hmm. So you have like Tolstoyism. His dad, Pasternak's dad, actually did a sketch of Tolstoy on his deathbed. So
that was nice of him.
Yeah, he got a call, and it was like, not a call. He got a note saying, "Hey, he's dying in secret. We're gonna go hide and do this." He was really close friends with his cousin Olga Friedenberg when he was a kid, mm-hmm. but her family moved to St. Petersburg. They reunited in 1910. They never became lovers. However, they wrote these fevered love letters to each other and were very clearly into each other, but that fizzled out and they became friends. He has a very interesting love life, a lot like Dr. Zhivago.
I was about to say, is that going to appear later as possibly a theme?
It is a theme. Laura is based off of a real person, and I'm going to devote a lot to her, so bear with me. Pasternak ended up falling in love with a woman named Ida Wisotskaya. She was from a Moscow Jewish family that were very important, and they owned a tea company, which is still one of the largest tea companies in the world.
Oh, neat.
They met when Boris's dad was painting her portrait. So he like went along with his dad and he's like, that chick is hot. He ended up tutoring Ida in her final classes of high school and helped her prep for finals. Mm-hmm. And then about this time he goes out to study in Germany, and everybody's like, you should get your degree, you should get a doctorate in German philosophy. And he's like, I have to go home. He ends up like talking to Ida, being madly in love with her. And her family is like, who the fuck is this guy? The family persuades Ida to turn him down for him being like, I want to marry you. And he ends up writing this whole poem about rejection called Marburg, which is one of his things. He becomes better known for a lot of his poetry until Dr. Zhivago. Mm-hmm. All right. So at this point in time, I stopped taking notes because there was too fucking much. And I'm relying a lot on Wikipedia, which you should never do, kids. But
Wikipedia is not a primary source.
It's not a primary source. So Ida was one of the great loves of his life. He ends up marrying a woman in 1922 named Eugenia Laurier. She's a student at the Art Institute. They have a son. Huh. Does that sound like Tanya? A little bit. this doesn't last forever. He ends Nothing up does. Getting married to another woman in 1932 named Zadeta Nyhaus, who is a wife of a Russian pianist. They get divorces and get married 2 years later. This cheating is a fairly common thing for Boris, as you're going to kind of
see. He sounds like a hot mess.
He was a hot mess. he did not like Stalin. He got into a lot of trouble for writing some horrible things. And then things start to go real bad in 1937. There was a show trial of two different people. And the Union of the Soviet Writers is requested to sign a document saying they support the death penalty for these two defendants. And Pasternak is like, why? Why would we do this? We're writers. Why would we support this? And so he refuses, and they break down his door and come to him and say, you're going to sign the fucking document. And he says, no, I'm not doing that. He ends up going to talk to Stalin and being like, this is stupid. Why would you do this? Which, wow. He was certain he was going to be arrested, and Stalin ended up crossing his name off of an execution list. There is an anecdote that says he either declared, do not touch this cloud dweller, or leave the holy fool alone. Holy fool alone was probably more accurate. There's a concept in Russia of the holy fool of, this person is so crazy, they must be a sign from God, leave him be. That's actually why the big famous, come on, you can do this, Brian. The big famous church in Moscow is not known by its real name. It's known more by the saint that was a crazy person. Anyway, so that's all fun. Olga Ivinskaya. This is the part that I have been hinting at for some time now. This woman was a fucking badass. So she is 34 years old. She looks a lot like Ida, which is not lost on historians. And so she is working for this paper called the Novy Mir. And Pasternak meets her because he's working with her. And he's like, I am into this woman. And just keep in mind, she's a 34-year-old single mom. She's already been through enough. And Pasternak is still married. He's still married to Zenaida. He doesn't leave Zenaida, but he does start an affair with Olga. Olga ends up becoming the basis for Laura. There's a whole book about it called Laura, which I will include in the show notes because it's fucking beautiful and insane. And so at first she kind of is pushing him away. She's like not really into it. He calls her basically every day. There was a recollection from her. It says he phoned almost every day and instinctively fearing to meet or talk with him, yet dying of happiness. I would stammer out, I was busy today, but almost every afternoon towards the end of working hours, he came in person to the office and often walked with me through the streets, boulevards and squares all the way home to Potapov Street. Shall I make you a present of this square? He would ask. Like, it was a big deal. Everybody knew he was having an affair. He ended up writing a bunch of poetry about her and things like that. In 1948, he told her she should probably quit her job at the Novy Mir because their relationship, everybody knew about it, and it was causing a lot of problems at work. They both were translating a lot of work at that time. So whenever they weren't doing, standard writing of their own, they would be translating things into Russian. And this was a big deal. They were part of the Soviet collective of writers, which is how they made their money. this is going on, everybody knows how much she means to him. So on the evening of October 6, 1949, the KGB come to her apartment because yes. Pasternak is, again, shooting his mouth off and doing, standing up for what he believes in, mm-hmm. which there's nothing wrong with that. But unfortunately, she...
It is in Russia.
It is in Russia. She is working on a translation and they break into her apartment. They ransack it. They take everything that's associated with Pasternak and they mm-hmm. pile it up in front of her. And they're like, this is why you're going to Lubyanka. Lubyanka is like the big prisons, the big KGB place where they torture people. And she's interrogated. She refuses to say anything bad about Pasternak. She won't give them any information. At the time, she was pregnant with his child. Mm-hmm. And she ended up having a miscarriage. She is thrown into the gulags for 10 years. The only mm-hmm. reason that she gets out, well, her 10-year sentence, mm-hmm. she's actually released, I believe, in 1953 because Stalin dies.
Yeah, that's a good way to get out.
After this time, Pasternak just starts referring to Stalin as the murderer, which is very dangerous.
And something you can do only after he's dead.
Yes. But he was doing this before.
Oh, shit.
He, at one point in time, was said that, according to an anecdote, that everything is finished now. They've taken her away from me. I'll never see her again. It's like death, even worse. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely terrifying for her family, terrifying for everybody. And he knew that she was in jail on his behalf. Mm-hmm. And the secret police let him know that. She's here, you know? The only reason that they couldn't touch him is because she wouldn't squeal.
Mm.
So I get real upset about this. Wonder why. It's a whole thing. So this book ends up being really, really important as a cultural zeitgeist mm-hmm. for a lot of reasons. The most is that after basically all this stuff happens with Olga, he mm-hmm. starts to finish this book that he's working on, Dr. Zhivago. He's been working on it for about, I think it's 10 years. He finishes it in 1955. He submits the novel to Novy Mir, and they're like, no, we're not publishing this. Honey, no, that's not happening. You have all sorts of stuff in here about individual characters not caring about the progress of society, caring about themselves. You're critiquing the gulags, the Great Purge, collectivization. You're criticizing Stalin. Your people are real pissed off about the revolution. We are not doing that. So he ends up meeting a guy named Sergio D'Angelo, who is a journalist, mm-hmm. and he's part of the Italian Communist Party, and he gets sent to the Soviet Union as a journalist, and you know, as a journalist and a member of the Communist Party. And he's like, I'm going to collect all this information about, you know, the Soviet Union, and I'm going to share it with my folks because, you know, we want to make sure that we're following the right path. He ends up getting this information about a book that Pasternak is working on, which is Dr. Zhivago.
Mm-hmm.
And Sergio goes, you know, I've been asked by this publisher in Milan if I find anything that could be of interest to Western readers to bring it back with me. And Pasternak is like, maybe. Are you sure? So he brings out the manuscript from his study and he says it's for a laugh and jokingly says, you're hereby invited to watch me face the firing squad, which is one of the most iconic statements that has been released about this book. So just mm-hmm. so you'll hear that a lot when you're researching this. And he's aware he's taking a huge risk. No Soviet author at the time was trying to work with a Western publisher. It just was not done.
No.
So Sergio's like, well, you know, we'll take it back and we'll see what will happen. He totally believes that Pasternak believes the current communist government and stuff like that and the affiliation, there's no way that this is going to get published in Italy. He thinks there's no way.
Yeah.
He's like, they might even just send it back to Russia and say it has to be published in Russia. There's no way. Mm-hmm. Olga and Zenaida were both horrified by the fact that he was sending it to a Western publishing house, even if he thought it was a joke. Mm-hmm. And he had to send all of these things, like going, you know what? I want this. I want this to happen. I want this to get published. It's announced that the book is going to be published. Soviet emissaries are falling all over themselves saying, no, you're not publishing this. This is not happening. They keep trying to cancel and delay publication. And the Italian publishing company is like, fuck that. They end up going to publish it. The Soviet government forces Pasternak to send multiple cables to the publisher to ask to withdraw the manuscript. But in the meantime, he's sending letters secretly saying, publish it at all costs. I don't care. This is where it gets good. It gets published in Italy.
Mm-hmm.
But the CIA finds out about it. And they're like, yes! Something, a fucking tool to get to the Soviet people. So they get this book. They buy a bunch of hard copies of it, which doesn't go well, by the way, because people are really suspicious. But when they get it into the small, little, easy to handle version of it, a lot like the paperbacks that they had during the World Wars, it becomes a hit. And I can imagine so. It's snuck in, and people start to read it and see all of these things that they've been lied to about from their government.
Mm-hmm.
And so the CIA is just absolutely loving it. Russia hates it. They start this whole campaign against Pasternak. They like try to take his money away from the collectivism, all that kind of stuff. He ends up in 1958 winning the Nobel Prize for it.
Mm-hmm.
They go back and forth going for several years. We don't know if we should award it to him or not. They finally do. And Pasternak is forced by the state to send a letter to the Nobel Prize team saying that he is unable to accept it, that he's infinitely grateful, but that he will have to decline because he does not feel that it is worthy of the Nobel Prize, which is bullshit, because what they happened was the USSR told him that if he left to go collect the Nobel Prize, he would not be welcomed back in the Soviet Union and he would be exiled, and he had nowhere to go.
I mean, in all fairness, they did something. This is like very similar to what happened to the guy that invented the theremin.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Because I will never forget that. Because these are things Amanda cares about, the inventor of the theremin.
So the end of his life sucked. And sorry, he didn't die of a heart attack. I had that wrong. He ended up dying of lung cancer in his house. And I have a video of his house in our notes.
My brain went too fast. And I thought you were going to say, I have a video of him dying. And it's like,
No.
Okay.
And he was worried that, you know, that Olga was going to continue to suffer without him, which was funny because she ended up kind of coming back towards the end of his life.
Okay.
He, according to a lot of people, he looked really hopeful about dying. Like, he was ready to be done and ready to die. And so he ends up dropping dead eventually at his house.
Mm-hmm.
So some really fun stuff is there is a writer who, what is the book called? I think it's called The Secrets We Kept. And it's about the CIA and the typing pool, like secretly putting the book together in English and in Russian and sending things out. There are a lot of documents that have come forth since, you know, because the CIA and the FBI and stuff will every few decades, I guess, release documentation of this is what happened now that it's safe for us to tell you.
Yeah.
And so a lot of times people kind of put those together. There is a really amazing book. And I think it's like, I'm trying to remember what it's called. Cause that's my brain doesn't work anymore, but it's about Pasternak and Dr. Zhivago and the CIA and all that kind of fun stuff.
Mm-hmm.
and it's why it's such was such a danger. And so that's really fascinating to read about, but it's a lot. It's a lot. You could, I know we're spending like, I think we're an hour in. There is so much more you could talk about with this book. There's so much more you can talk about with Pasternak himself, the mm-hmm. Russian Revolution, communism, Russia as a whole. I mean, there's mm-hmm. a lot. So,
I mean, realistically, like,